Want to be a part of the conversation? Then let us know on the TNT Radio Interactive Live Chat Room at tntradio.live. Lighting the fuse for freedom. Today's news talk, TNT Radio. Using science to debunk myths. From the pandemic to climate fraud. Thanks for listening to Sky Dragon Slaying on TNT Radio.
Hi, and welcome to another episode of Sky Dragon Slaying, where we bring you the truth on science and current affairs the mainstream would rather you didn't know. I'm John O'Sullivan, CEO of Principia Scientific International. As usual, joining me is Canadian astrophysicist Joe Posmer and Texan engineer extraordinaire Joe Olson. In this episode, we're very honoured and excited to have with us the brilliant MIT scientist and researcher, Stephanie Seneff, PhD. Dr. Seneff is a senior research scientist at MIT's Computer Science and Artificial Intelligence Laboratory in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and has published over 200 peer-reviewed papers in scientific journals and conference proceedings. In recent years, Stephanie's interest has focused more on the role of toxic chemicals and micronutrient deficiencies in health and disease, and she's written an important book, Toxic Legacy, an expose of the world's most common weed killer, Roundup. In this interview, though, we're hoping to cover a very wide range of subjects where Dr. Seneff is recognized as possessing great insight. These include what might be behind the dramatic rise in autism, the role of minerals in our body's electrical supply, COVID-19 vaccines, cholesterol sulfate, glyphosate, and the role of vitamin D in health and illness. Dr. Seneff knows the medical literature on these subjects in a way that few other people do. Some of her conclusions will surprise and challenge you. For example, she makes a compelling case that vitamin D supplementation is not a good idea. Hi, Stephanie. How are you today?
I'm fine. Thank you for asking.
Oh, it's such a pleasure to finally get to talk to you. We know you're very busy. And what I like about your work is you think outside the box. You're one of those scientists. You cross disciplines. You like to dabble in fields other people say you shouldn't dabble in. You know, your specialisms more in line with the computer side of things, artificial intelligence. But, you know, your fascination with health is so timely. Like ourselves, my colleagues Joe Posmer and Joe Olson, we, like many people during the pandemic, are becoming very concerned about allopathic medicine, the lies mm-hmm. we've been fed by Big Pharma, and the fact that we're being pretty much systematically poisoned by so many chemicals. And we're so happy to have you on that case. Now, you're not afraid to pull your punches. You're quite outspoken on that, and you're not afraid to, you know, speak your mind on it. You collaborated on a peer-reviewed study, I believe, with Dr. Gred Nye, a peer-reviewed US study that found that the experimental COVID vaccines caused multiple serious adverse side effects. And, mm-hmm. you know, you took a lot of flack for that. And, you know, all credit to you for speaking out. It's you know, scientists and researchers like you that we really admire. Can you give us a flavor of what inspired you to get into this line of work? Why diversify the way you have?
Yeah, that's a good question. I've actually always loved biology, and I like a puzzle, and biology is a magnificent puzzle. And I've always, you know, been interested. I've read books, you know, all kinds, just kept up with biology throughout my career. I have an undergraduate degree in biophysics. My graduate degree is in computer science and electrical engineering. And most of my career was developing software capabilities for the computer to communicate with humans using natural speech. And so very, very different from biology, although I studied the biology of speech understanding by humans to try to figure out how to model the computer version of that. So I did have some links to biology through that work. But it was really along 2007 timeframe that I got worried about autism. That's the thing that really got me interested in studying the role of toxic chemicals in disease. And I was lucky that I was able to just transition to that new field, really, you know, and sort of start over my career at that point, trying to figure out which toxic chemicals might be causing autism, because I was seeing the rates go up year by year. And, you know, we're just diagnosing it more, don't worry about it. And I didn't believe that for one minute. I thought there's got to be something that's causing this. It's not just genetic, you know. And so I really, really wanted to figure out what it was. And spent 5 years learning a lot about autism, reading all about the comorbidities and the complexities of that disease. And looking for different things in the environment that were also going up dramatically and pretty much striking out. I was quite frustrated after about 5 years. I had looked at vaccines. I think they play a role, but I didn't think that was the only role and maybe not even the primary cause. And so I was looking for something else. I happened to be at a conference, 2012. Professor Don Huber, who's a retired professor from Purdue University, an expert in plant biology and plant physiology. And he gave a 2-hour presentation on glyphosate. I didn't know what glyphosate was when I walked into the room. But of course, by the time I came out, I was like, oh my God, this is it. I was so convinced because it fit so well. I understood autism quite well. And he was talking about, and he's a plant person. So he knew about the soil and the soil microbiome and how the plants don't pick up the minerals that they should, including sulfur, of course, but all, various minerals become deficient when the plants are exposed to glyphosate. And then the fact that glyphosate disrupts the gut microbiome because they share the enzymes with the plants that glyphosate suppresses. And then you go, and I knew the gut microbiome was going on with autism because I could see so many autistic kids have a lot of gut problems. So I was looking for something in the food, something in the water. That was where I was thinking. And then once I did some more research, I went back and found the first paper I read was Seralini's paper, which was on a long-term rat study. He basically, so Seralini's a professor in France, and he and his team reproduced a study that had been done originally by Monsanto, pretty much the same protocol, except that they kept going. So Monsanto had looked for 3 months, giving the rats a small dose, a low-dose glyphosate compared to the controls. And after 3 months, they didn't really see any problems. So they said, we're good to go. It doesn't affect animals. It's great. But they kept going, and they went through the entire lifespan of the rats, continuing to expose them to low-dose glyphosate. And then they found all kinds of problems that started to appear at 4 months. So it's a slow kill, which is part of the reason why we don't know that it's so toxic. And it also is more toxic at low doses than at high doses. This is a feature of endocrine disruptors, and glyphosate is definitely an endocrine disruptor. And that is really bad news. So there's many different ways in which it affects our biology. My book goes into great detail. I try to keep the science as, you know, accessible as possible, which is quite challenging in some cases, but it's fascinating. And I am really, really worried about the future as we continue to use more and more glyphosate every year. We don't think that's a problem. Our government's not even looking to see how much is in the food. They know it's all over the food supply. They don't care. Meanwhile, autism rates keep going up exactly in step with a rise in glyphosate usage on core crops. So it's disturbing to me that I'm screaming to the rooftops to get this message out because there are so many parents. Now it's 1 in 36 in the United States. It's just shocking, the numbers. So many kids, and many of them can't speak. I mean, they're going to be lifetime care. When they age out of childhood, there aren't any facilities to take care of them. The parents are going to get old and sick and die. We're going to have all these adults with autism. We won't know what to do with them. I mean, it's really a frightening future that I see. As we continue to ignore this problem and not try to find the answer. The government doesn't seem to even want to find the answer.
Stephanie, you said something really interesting, if you don't mind my jumping in. You said that it's more toxic at low dosage. And I think probably a lot of people don't understand why that would be. Would you mind explaining that to the guests? Because that's interesting.
That is interesting. And that's a characteristic feature of endocrine disruptors. And there's a recent paper, actually, a lot of good papers are coming out in the last few years. A recent paper that was a review paper looking at the evidence to support the fact that glyphosate is an endocrine disruptor. And that's a feature of all, there are many different chemicals that are endocrine disruptors, and they have this property that they're really toxic at low doses. And that's really because the whole mechanism by which the cells take up the glyphosate is different if there's too much of it. If there's a lot of it in the environment, it doesn't actually get picked up by the receptors that would normally be looking for. Endocrine signals are very low dose. And so when glyphosate's low dosage, it simulates the endocrine, for example, it's an estrogen mimetic. And so it looks like estrogen when it's at low dose. But if there's too much of it, that doesn't happen anymore. It's really quite interesting. It must sort of, something about the biophysics of having a lot that it can't quite fit. I don't know actually why that is, but it's certainly been seen that the low doses are really toxic with respect to the endocrine system.
Yes, in the endocrine system, that's all about your hormones, correct?
Absolutely, absolutely. And yes, so, and it really messes things up.
Yeah, and so isn't there going to be a direct connection then between, impaired sexual expression? Like, what would that be behind what's causing this transgenderism in modern day?
I know. I actually, I do believe that toxic environmental exposures are a major player in this epidemic that we're seeing in transgender and the young people. It's so amazing to me that the numbers are shocking. I have heard 4% of the young adults or the teenagers, maybe. I mean, the numbers are just absolutely mind-blowing. Transgender was not something I knew about until I was, 20 years ago. So it's really strange.
Well, it's quite interesting because while we have this chemical effect going on, due to the chemical exposure, the environmental exposure, we also have the intentional social effect of bringing this intentionally into schools and pushing it on our children. So how strange that those would work in unison. It would almost be like, it's too coincidental for them to be accidentally working together. It's more like a plan.
I know. And the same with autism, by the way. We're trying, we have this sort of neurodivergence. Yeah. Neurodiversity. And so autistic, it's fine if you can't speak, that's okay. It's just another way to be human. I mean, it just shocks me that.
Yeah, but the neurodiversity they don't want. They do not want the neurodiversity of reason and rationality. They'll take neurodiversity for any degenerate or ridiculous concept. But
I know. I think they appreciate
you're an INTJ neurodiverse for reason and rationality. Oh, no, they do not want you then.
Yeah, well, I tell you, atrazine is another herbicide, just like glyphosate. Glyphosate, by the way, is Roundup, and I think you mentioned that. People know the word Roundup a lot more than they know glyphosate, but atrazine is another herbicide, and I think it's the second most used herbicide. Glyphosate is the most used herbicide in the world, and that's partly because it's considered, mainly because it's considered to be safe, compared to the others. And atrazine is known to be very toxic, and Tyrone Hayes, who's a professor at Berkeley, he's been studying atrazine for many years, and I've heard him give a couple talks. He's really great, and he he exposed tadpoles to atrazine, and he found that the male tadpoles with the XY chromosome, some percentage of them actually turned into females. They developed as females with complete reproductive capacity in the eggs. They had eggs that were fertile, which is just amazing, but they're XY. So they have the male genes, but they don't use them properly. They just, the atrazine suppresses. Normally, the embryo will end up female if there isn't any of this influence from the testosterone and all the sort of, male hormones. But somehow, the male hormones were ignored in these tadpoles that were exposed to atrazine. So they become males. So the other males were probably also messed up too, but maybe not as much,
Yeah, I do remember in the 90s, in Southern Ontario, at least, where there's a lot of, John, you want to jump in?
Yeah, you reminded me of a wonderful article written by Dr. Peter McCullough back in April this year on autism spectrum disorder and gender dysphoria. And he picked up on a study at CDC. It indicated that one in 36 children have been identified with autism spectrum disorder.
That's just amazing, isn't it?
It's shocking. And the point being that we are kind of, together, interdisciplinary scientists are making the connections between things like glyphosate, Roundup, autism, and gender dysphoria. It's beginning to be a pattern. And I hate to be opening ourselves up to claims that build conspiracy theorists, but when you see a pattern, you do kind of put out a hypothesis that it may be connected. And part of our concern is that Monsanto don't want to be investigated. They don't want to disclose their data at all. They've been quite unforthcoming in their whole methodology. And it's a case of actually forcing the issue, isn't it? We've got to force it. And the work you're doing is very important. I like the idea that gender dysphoria is now being talked about more than just about transsexualism, because many psychologists and psychiatrists will say that the proper term has always been gender dysphoria. It's not really the trans thing as we know. My profession as a school teacher, I was a school teacher for 20 odd years, and we never saw this. I've never in my professional career seen this at all. I've taught many thousands of children. It's very much something that's occurred in the last few years.
And I think that maybe transgenerational effects it's very interesting. I mean, there were studies that showed that when you expose the female pregnant rat to low-dose glyphosate during a critical period of pregnancy, the germline is very sensitive to that, and it will actually, through epigenetic mechanisms, will remember that exposure, and it shows up as problems, and in many cases, reproductive problems, in two or three generations later. It'll manifest itself later. So the offspring look okay. Mm-hmm. Their offspring look problematic. The next generation looks even worse. I mean, it's just amazing. And they've done these studies with multiple generations of rats with glyphosate and other of these endocrine disrupting chemicals. And this is something they know about. The researchers understand this, that the exposure during pregnancy at a critical period will have long-term effects that won't show up until the next generation or even the generation after that.
Yeah, we're talking to Dr. Stephanie Seneff. This is TNT Radio.
You should hear what Kate Shimarani is talking about.
We were told Britain on lockdown alert as new killer virus, which kills 40% of victims, certain to reach the UK. Oh gosh, if you're a Muppet out there believing that, you need to go and get that CT scan of your head to check that there is some grey matter in there looking a little bit like a walnut. If it was that deadly, do you not think they'd have shut the borders? But you're all still going on your jollies to Benidorm and Torremolinas and Dubai and Egypt and wherever else you're going. And then you're all coming back. Who remembers the nurse who allegedly got Ebola? Ebola, that deadly hemorrhagic disease that we're all going to die of. Or virus, was it? Who knows? And they flew her back into the UK to be treated. They flew her back into a country that didn't have it. That's what they did. And so if you believe in all of that now, like I say, you need to go in the bathroom and slap yourself. Anyway, we're told that children are being exposed to toxic levels of lead in school drinking water. There is no toxic level. It's all toxic. You shouldn't be having any of it.
Kate Shimarani on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Radio works because of its ability to personalize to the listener.
What's exciting these days is that people are rediscovering it. You know, people are really rediscovering just how powerful radio is, how ubiquitous it is. It's in our cars, it's in our homes. There are so many new ways to access it. It's everywhere.
To find out more, go to tntradio.live. Scraping together all the news and information you need.
It's engaging.
At the top and bottom of the hour. Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back to Sky Dragon Slaying. We're so happy to have with us Dr. Stephanie Seneff. She's a truther like us. And going back into maybe 2014, 2015 or so, Dr. Seneff and her MIT colleagues were working on the health impacts of fat and cholesterol consumption in America. And based on this work, Dr. Seneff, you claim that Americans are suffering from a cholesterol deficiency, not an excess. And you made the point that it was worth litigating, and the case was going to go to court with the Pfizer drug Lipitor, but unfortunately the court threw the case out, claiming that you weren't a valid expert witness. This is what happens, isn't it, really? The lawfare system is going to do what it does, and but you started the ball rolling, and it's something that very few people have considered before. So give us a little taste of what you were finding about the cholesterol deficiency issue.
Right. It's sort of shocking when people hear that, because they are all trying to eat a low cholesterol diet in order to protect themselves from heart disease. And I think it's definitely the wrong way to go. It's really interesting that the industry has gotten that message across. And it's really just because I think they worked it backwards, that they found this statin drugs, you know, and they found out that they mess up the enzymes in the liver that make cholesterol. And then, so they wanted to believe that if I've got a drug that can do this, we want to make sure that people think that's a good thing to do, right? To disrupt the liver from making cholesterol. And then you can sell your product and make a lot of money. And I think they've basically twisted that message to the point where so many people, a huge percentage of the population, especially as they age, get themselves on a statin drug for life, you know? And it's causing all kinds of nasty side effects, and they don't even realize it, that the statin drug is causing all those problems. They think they're just getting old, because basically statins make you get older faster. That's pretty much a good way to describe their symptom profile. And cholesterol is very interesting. And in fact, what I talk a lot about is cholesterol sulfate, and more generally about sulfate and about sulfation pathways and their disruption. And at the time, I didn't realize they were being disrupted by glyphosate. When I first started doing biology, you know, getting back into biology as part of my job, I really found cholesterol sulfate was one of the first things I looked into, both with respect to heart disease and autism. I saw a link there of cholesterol sulfate deficiency being linked to both conditions. And it's really, really interesting because cholesterol sulfate is, sulfation is a technique that the body uses to convert fat-soluble molecules into water-soluble molecules. And it does it for a lot of things, including all the hormones like the sex hormones and cortisol and thyroid hormone, neurotransmitters like dopamine and serotonin and melatonin. They're all sulfated when they're shipped around in the blood. And it's a crucial step that needs to take place in order to distribute these extremely important biological molecules. And so if you have a problem with a toxic exposure that disrupts your ability to stick sulfate onto these molecules, you are in bad shape. And I think that's a more general story of what's going on, is that the entire sulfation pathways are disrupted by glyphosate. I talk about that a lot in my book. I believe this is true, and it has not been proven experimentally, but I can see indirect evidence, I would say, from various sources that kind of link together the puzzle to show that if it is true, it explains a lot of the all this diverse conditions and diseases that are going up dramatically in our population, exactly in step with the rise in glyphosate usage. So I think it's a sulfation problem, which means that cholesterol can't get sulfated. For example, in the liver, studies have shown that cholesterol sulfate actually protects the liver from fatty liver disease, but cholesterol causes it. So it's basically that when you have this cholesterol in the liver that you can't sulfate, then you can't just ship it out. You know, you have to put it somewhere. You have to store it basically in the liver, and then you have to store fat with it, and you get fatty liver disease. And so that if you can't sulfate the cholesterol in the liver, your liver is going to get sick. And it's true for vitamin D too, by the way. Vitamin D gets sulfated and distributed that way. So you have to package up these fat soluble molecules into LDL particles. The liver has to do that if it can't sulfate it. If it can sulfate it, it can just ship it out. And that's a crucial difference. The sulfate makes it water soluble, and it actually goes into the membranes of all these lipid particles that are in the blood. The cholesterol sulfate goes into the membranes and sticks the sulfate out into the blood, out into the water-based solution that it's in, which is usually blood. And so that sulfate actually solubilizes the lipid particle and also builds a structured water around it that protects it. It builds this what's called exclusion zone water around the lipid particle to protect it from glycation damage, oxidation damage, all of these, you know, dangerous things that are lurking in the blood that could mess up that particle, could oxidize it, could glycate it. Those are what, it's the oxidized and glycated forms of LDL that are what cause the trouble with heart disease. So if you can get the sulfate going, stick it on the cholesterol, put the cholesterol in the membrane with the sulfate, that makes that particle negatively charged and protected from whatever else is in the blood so that it can be safely transported to wherever it needs to go. And it goes all over the body, including the brain, delivering the cholesterol and the sulfate to the systemically.
Stephanie, would you simply say, though, that the pharmaceutical industry, big pharma, is basically running off the principle of profit in illness? It's something we've discussed quite often on the show. You know, particularly you brought up the example of the statin drugs, which attack cholesterol, but they really just make you sick in other ways, which then big pharma gets to sell you more drugs. So aren't they basically just operating on that principle? Profit in illness, especially if they can make you sick and sell
absolutely
you more drugs.
Absolutely. And I think the same thing goes for the chemicals. You often find that the toxic chemicals like glyphosate, all the chemicals that are used in agriculture, we're going to end up being poisoned by those chemicals because we eat the food. And then those chemicals are going to make us sick. And then they're ready with a drug to help treat the symptoms of that poison. So they get you coming and going. I mean, it's the same industry, right? A lot of the agrochemical industry companies are really umbrellaed by the pharmaceutical companies these days.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, they're all working together, basically. And one other topic that John O'Sullivan and Joe Olson love to bring up is terrain theory versus germ theory. And this relates to that, too, especially with the statin drugs and the cholesterol. So, you know, we have this terrible environmental toxicity through our diet mainly. And, you know, so then they just identified, oh, well, people are eating this terrible diet and you have heart disease, you have a lot of cholesterol. So it must be the cholesterol. But the cholesterol was the body actually trying to save the heart and the arteries, correct me if I'm wrong, but
no, that's right.
From this terribly acidic diet, and then they attack the cholesterol, but the cholesterol was trying to save you.
Yes. And in fact, you know, if you eat cholesterol, it's quite interesting to see what happens to it, because the cholesterol goes into the chylomicron, which is this giant lipid particle, much bigger than an LDL particle. And the chylomicrons get shipped through the lymph system from the gut, through the lymph system, and they come out into the blood right at the major vein in the shoulders that goes straight to the heart. So the heart gets first dibs on that cholesterol that's in your diet. It goes first to the heart, and the heart is very happy to have it. So I think it is a cholesterol deficiency problem with heart disease. When the heart becomes deprived of cholesterol and sulfate, it becomes sick.
Mm-hmm. Another thing.
And then, of course, if you don't eat cholesterol, then your liver has to make it. So that's how you get the LDL particles, because your liver doesn't have to make LDL if you've got that chylomicron coming in. But you've got a deficiency in your diet, and therefore the liver has to make the LDL, and the LDL levels go up.
Yeah, I wanted to jump on something that Dr. Joe Mercola picked up on. He reviewed your book, Toxic Legacy, How Glyphosate Destroys Your Health, back in January 2022. And one of the things he noted that you were focusing on was celiac disease, and wonderful connection, you know, with the thing with the wheat, the idea that barley, legumes, oats, chickpeas and lentils, they're all very high in glyphosate. And a lot of people are complaining about their so-called intolerances. You know, it's the idea that it's the bread, it's these things. They're missing the point, aren't they? They're kind of being diverted away from the real course. And as you say, I think we're onto something where, again, with conspiracy theory hat on here, but if they're making us sick deliberately, they're coming up with the cures for the diseases they're causing. And it's something that I think more of us should be aware of and just point the finger a little bit and then just see how they react. Do you think that's a fair assessment?
Yeah. Well, furthermore, it's not a cure, right? It's just a treatment, and they're hoping it's a lifetime treatment. Exactly. So they can make, so for example, obesity is another one, but I definitely agree with the celiac disease. I think I wrote about that in my book. And I think that it's a consequence of glyphosate in the wheat, and wheat based products do have high glyphosate. These are all non-GMO products, by the way, the ones you just listed, non-GMO. So people think, oh, non-GMO, good, I'll buy that. That's not right, because a lot of the highest levels of glyphosate are found in these non-GMO crops that are sprayed right before harvest as a desiccant, intentionally killing the plant. And that increases the yield and it gets it ready for clearance. You know, it kind of makes it go brown quicker and easier to clear the crop and get a head start on next year's weeds. I mean, there's various reasons why they like to do it, but they're doing it for all these crops that are non-GMO and the wheat in particular. And so I have actually looked into glyphosate, and I mentioned glyphosate disrupting the gut microbiome. And in fact, a lovely paper showed two particular species in the gut that are very sensitive to glyphosate, which is Lactobacillus and Bifidobacteria. Those are major, important, beneficial microbes in our gut. So they get killed off by the glyphosate, and that's how you get an overgrowth of pathogens, and you get inflammation in the gut. Inflammatory bowel disease is going up exactly with glyphosate. And interestingly enough, celiac disease is going up over time exactly in step with glyphosate usage on wheat. We actually have separate data for wheat, and that matches better with celiac disease than glyphosate usage on corn and soy, which is interesting. Mm-hmm. But those bacteria actually help you break down the wheat. The wheat has a lot of proline in it, and proline is a difficult amino acid to break apart from the chain. And we have a lot of deficiencies, you know, which the microbes have so many more enzymes than we do that can do all kinds of fancy things. And one of them is to help with the breaking apart of the wheat protein, the gluten. And so when those microbes are sick, and it's harder to break down the gluten, you end up with these peptides that don't get broken down into individual amino acids, which then allow you to use those amino acids to make your own proteins. But instead, you get this peptide, it's intact. And that those peptides are a problem for the immune cells. They don't like them because they're foreign, and they develop antibodies to them. And then those antibodies attack your own tissues through something called molecular mimicry. So that's really a lot of the basis of celiac disease.
As you know, Stephanie, there's a huge market out there for gluten-free grains. But do you think that's really just a smokescreen for what is the true underlying problem, which is glyphosate?
Well, of course. I mean, I really think it's so clear to me that glyphosate is a major factor in gluten intolerance. And it puzzles me that people don't just jump on that as soon as they hear it. It's like, wow, that's got to be right. That would be my reaction, you know?
Yeah, so it's not gluten. It's the glyphosate.
Joe, I think so.
Yeah, I came from a generation that was already skeptic about defoliants because between 1961 and 71, the United States sprayed 20 million gallons of Agent Orange called in a what was called Operation Ranch Hand all over Vietnam with enormous amount of health defects as a result of that. And they fought for a decade to keep veterans from being able to get benefits. And they went, okay, Agent Orange is pretty bad. But when Monsanto got approval from the FDA in 1974, they were the only ones that tested the safety of glyphosate.
Yes.
And time, one of the researchers that was independent got a hold of their test results. And what they claimed was that glyphosate was perfectly safe because there was a common element in clay soils that immediately caused it to metabolize and that it had no residual effect. And now after spraying it for 40 years, we have places where we sprayed it 40 years ago that there's still residual effect. And it turns out the common clay molecule that they claimed in their FDA was absolutely false. So they falsified this stuff, and the FDA doesn't have enough brains or intestinal fortitude to demand legitimate studies. And when there are claims made against these people, they don't get independent analysis. But we've got a problem there. But I also want to talk in a little while about rhodiolene. That's a fish side for killing fish, and it's absolutely stunning. It's equally as bad.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that goes in the water. A lot of fresh water. It's been pumped into fresh water to reduce the fish population, to change species. I mean, it's insane, isn't it? The commercialization of species in freshwater farming. It's something that concerns me.
Yes, that's very scary. And they've got the GMO salmon now too, which are really, which I'm very worried about. They apparently go blind. And yeah, they grow really fast and they go blind. It can't be good, right?
No,
something
they're playing
like that.
God, really, aren't they? They're playing God.
They really are. I am so disturbed by everything. I mean, it started with glyphosate, but now there's so many things going on. I can't keep up with them all. I've been following fake meat, meat grown in the lab and all this stuff.
Stephanie, you mentioned a slow kill, the phrase slow kill earlier. So, I mean, we're only 30 minutes into the show. That's a pretty, scary sounding phrase, but are we? Is that your opinion?
Yeah, I think so.
What do you mean by that?
What I mean by that is that when Monsanto did the studies, they actually set up rules of the game that said if it doesn't look like it's a problem at high dose, you don't have to look at low dose. And if it doesn't look like it's a problem after 3 months of exposing animals, you don't have to look any longer. They set up those rules. And so glyphosate was able to pass their tests by that strategy. I think they probably discovered that. Yeah, well, I think they discovered when they looked at low dose, or if they took a little longer, things started to show up. So they just defined the rules to keep them from finding that. That would be my guess, right? They had these formal rules that allowed them to get it approved because they were able to avoid seeing the evidence by just not doing that experiment.
Yeah, I've got a few numbers for you. I mean, the agricultural use of glyphosate in the US grew from 27.5 million pounds in 1995 to nearly 250 million pounds in 2014. That's according to a report from the Environmental Sciences in Europe. A report by Food Democracy Now, in collaboration with the Detox Project, they found in 29 of America's favorite processed foods, cereals, crackers, cookies, and corn chips, that it's endemic. It's everywhere you go. That virtually no food that you can take, you can consume, avoiding this awful chemical. And I've seen some figures that say on an average year, a typical American is consuming about a pound of glyphosate. It really is beyond belief. It's in drinking water. The EPA allows up to 700 parts per billion of glyphosate in drinking water.
Which is much higher than other countries.
Yeah, I mean, it's insane. I mean, where can you go to actually get a clean diet?
Now you have to go away from the United States, unfortunately, which is really sad. You know, I just, I don't know what's the matter with our, I mean, I do know what's the matter with our regulators, but I certainly wish it weren't true. And they just get, as long as they get their pockets full of money, they're willing to look the other way. They don't want to fight it.
Yeah, that's what Joe Olson says in the chat here. Captured FDA, basically they're owned, aren't they? They're owned, the FDA is owned and run by Monsanto, basically, right?
Yeah.
One of the courses I take as a civil engineer was environmental engineering, and we're in charge of doing water quality for potable water systems, which is your drinking water, as well as wastewater systems. And at the time I was in college, we were just getting mass spectrometers and electron microscopes, and so we were being able to use that incoming technology, but we still did most of our work using titration. And we would do biological oxygen demand, chemical oxygen demand, and total suspended solids in order to verify that water samples were safe. And the crazy thing is that in fresh water, the amount of dissolved oxygen is about 6 or 7 parts per million. In seawater, it's about 4 or 5 parts per million. Now, compare that with the atmosphere, which is 20% oxygen, which is 200,000 parts per million. And then they come up with this fishicide called Rotazyme that has been proven now to have effects with Parkinson's. And this was something that Tim Truth had. So, you know, we're poisoning ourselves every way possible. And I go to the Texas Parks and Wildlife, and they wholeheartedly endorse this. I have a pond with a half acre pond, and I stocked it with catfish. And a few years later, I started noticing there weren't that many catfish, but there was a lot of carp and alligator gar. So I contacted the agricultural extension agent. Oh, said no problem. Just go get some Rotatine, and you can kill all the bad fish and then restock it with the good ones. And I went, well, wait a minute. My pond has fresh water brine shrimp. I had salamanders and a thing called a sirene, which is a primitive form of amphibian that has external gills and has 2 front legs. Those things can't live in water that's not pretty healthy. Yeah. So I just had to deal with having carp and alligator gar, because I was not going to kill my healthy lake in order to come back and do some monoculture fishing. So, but that's the standard protocol, is that's the way our Parks and Wildlife Department treat it. And no wonder this stuff. And then when you read the cautions about not drinking any of the water and not allowing livestock to get near the water, I mean, it's just, and then it's just willy-nilly go to the, tractor supply. You can pick up all of it you want. Absolutely crazy that we allow this chemical toxicity to be randomly installed by anybody that's got a credit card.
Right.
Yeah, this is TNT Radio. We'll be right back.
With his expert analysis and opinion, this is TNT Radio's Timothy Shea.
File this under Play Stupid Games, Win Stupid Prizes. Members of the Last Generation environmental group in Hamburg and Dusseldorf in Germany accessed airport runways last week and affixed their hands to the runways using a combination of epoxy resin and concrete. The mixture, commonly used as an adhesive in construction, is unable to be dissolved, and in extreme cases, requiring amputation in order to remove the hands from the runways. It's uncertain whether or how many of the group's hands needed to be amputated, but if they did, that tissue would simply join the carbon cycle, something that the young environmentalist might want to study before doing something so extreme. Carbon goes into the air as we breathe out CO2, and then it's reabsorbed by plants that breathe in CO2. It's a cycle. You can neither create nor destroy carbon. It just goes in a big circle. It's not a pollutant, and it's not a threat to the environment. From MAGAInstitute.com, this is Timothy Shea for TNT Radio.
Engine 2, respond emergency, structure fire. Address is somewhere in the downtown region. House in question is medium-ish in size. It's a stucco house, a mostly stucco house, and it's kind of near a parking lot. Over.
If we can't find you, we can't help you. If you call 911 from a cell phone, please be prepared to give us your exact location. Visit ecom911.ca to learn more. Ecom 911. Help us help.
When government efficiency is about as good as the smell of a rest area bathroom.
Quite frankly, it stinks.
You need today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back to Sky Dragon Slang. We're dishing out the truth on the big pharma issues and the food supply. And the question we keep asking is it safe? Dr. Stephanie Senef, you're helping us here. Just a few facts to go back to the fact that the regulators are not helping us. In 2015, the World Health Organization, WHO Cancer Research Agency, IARC, declared that glyphosate probably causes cancer, citing limited evidence that the herbicide may cause non-Hodgkin lymphoma in humans and convincing evidence that it causes cancer in laboratory animals. The EPA then came to a similar conclusion. They reversed their decision for not having enough evidence. It seems to be a pattern because they don't want to do the investigations. They don't want to do the hard science. It's a case of don't look over here, look over here. What I want to get on to, if that's okay with you, Stephanie, is, again, joining the dots. I mean, 3 years we've had now, 3 long years of being kind of exposing the lies of Big Pharma. And the methodology is pretty clear, isn't it? Anybody that goes against the narrative is either deplatformed, ghosted, or discredited, lose their careers. It's something that you yourself have suffered a little bit. It's something that's going to get worse before it gets better. And I think we're looking at trying to recruit more and more scientists. And one of the things that I really enjoyed seeing was a former chief scientist at Pfizer, Mike Yellen, came out earlier a few months ago to, again, raise the question about the dangers of the vaccines. And it's something we're going to have to factor that in as well. I mean, we're joining the dots, aren't we? It's everything is connected, isn't it, Stephanie?
Yes, absolutely. And I will say that I believe that COVID, when you look at different countries and how sensitive they were to COVID and, you know, mortality rates and severe disease across different countries, you find a pattern. And in particular, part of the pattern is that the United States is very sensitive to COVID. We have a much higher mortality rate than other countries. And on the other hand, Africa, most of Africa does very, very well with COVID, with very low mortality rate. And I think that's very interesting. And of course, also the fact individually that people with comorbidities, they know which comorbidities are linked to more severe disease. And that includes diabetes, obesity, heart disease, Alzheimer's disease. I mean, all these different things that are going up in the United States, exactly in step with the rise in glyphosate usage, you know, and so to me, it looks like there's a link. There's a link between high exposure to glyphosate and risk of a severe disease with COVID-19.
Yeah, another link we find is with our TNT colleagues. Our wonderful host on TNT Radio is Jeremy Nell, does germ warfare. He's down in South Africa, and he makes the point, jokingly, of course, that South Africa is pretty much a failed state. Government regulations are not fully implemented. And the other fact being that if you don't follow the narrative, if you don't mask up and get vaccinated, you don't get sick. And it's something that we've been seeing ourselves. And you know, I write books, and my recent book, co-authored by Dr. Judy Weinerman, you know, slaying the virus and vaccine dragon, we've found in our research that although there is a lot of talk about the COVID virus, there's no actual gold standard isolate. And it's something that we've been working on. I know you were interviewed by Dr. Tom Cohen recently, great colleague of Dr. Andy Kaufman and Dr. Sam Bailey, who would argue, you know, the real thing here is terrain theory, you know, increase your immune system. And that in itself is more than good enough, than any better than any vaccine. And I know you tend to agree with that, don't you?
Oh, well, yes. Well, in fact, the exosomes are very, very interesting. And I have been doing a deep dive into exosomes. And Cowan argues that, you know, exosomes are very much like viruses, which is true. They're lipid particles. They have a lot in common with viruses. And they have a lot of interesting things inside of them. Exosomes are lipid particles that are released by cells, often under stress conditions. They'll just dump the toxin that they're dealing with into the exosome and ship it out and just let the other cells deal with it. You know, like, I can't handle this, so you take care of it for me, type of thing. Just dump their garbage. But they put all kinds of things in exosomes, and they're actually a communication network for the cells. It's really, really fascinating. I've been reading a whole lot about exosomes, and I think Tom Cowan's big point is that there is kind of a gradation. You know, exosomes and viruses have a lot in common. The big difference really is that viruses can reproduce themselves. Normally, exosomes can't, you know. they have the enzymes that you need to, and exosomes can carry RNA. They can carry messenger RNA perfectly fine. They protect it from being broken down. So in theory, they could be a virus, except for the fact that they don't have the tools necessary to copy the RNA and to clone and to make a new version of themselves. They can't clone themselves. That's really the big distinction between exosomes and viruses. I think that exosomes play a very, very important role in the reaction to a virus infection. I believe viruses are real. I think the COVID-19 SARS-CoV-2 is real. I think it's lab produced. It was constructed in the Wuhan laboratory. It has extremely interesting pieces in it that are extremely unlikely to have appeared by chance. And so there's a lot of evidence. And actually that evidence is growing, that the concept that it was came out of this research in the laboratory in Wuhan. So I don't embrace the idea that the virus doesn't exist. But what I do feel is that there's an interplay between the virus and the exosomes in order to carry out the whole process of the disease experience. And I just read a paper, was quite fascinating, that showed that exosomes are a major part of the process when you catch the disease. And these researchers actually got exosomes from people who had a mild case of COVID while they were suffering from a mild case. And then they extracted exosomes from people who were suffering from a severe case. And they found, interestingly enough, that the exosomes from the mild case were busy setting up a situation where you could make antibodies to protect. Whereas the other exosomes were releasing inflammatory agents. They were basically making the disease worse. And so it sort of says that the mild case is the consequence of a healthy immune system. And with a healthy immune system, the exosomes express that health by virtue of having the right ingredients to keep things tame, to not have too much inflammation. Whereas when you have a weak immune system, then those exosomes are going to express that weakness by setting up all kinds of nasty things that are going to cause tissue damage. So it's really, really interesting to me. The exosomes are an indicator of the health of the immune system.
Tiffany, you mentioned the Wuhan lab, and that is likely where the COVID-19 virus came from. And of course, we hear Fauci use this phrase, gain of function research, over and over again, where it really just seems to come down to it being research for how to make new pathogens. Like, is it basically just a get rich quick scheme? Because look at how rich they all became from it. I mean, is this what we're dealing with? Is this the type of people we're dealing with?
I still can't figure it all out. I do think the vaccines were driving the whole response. The idea that you could get the mRNA technology out the door if you could force people to take this vaccine and rush it through the regulatory process, whereas it would have failed if you had done it right, to get it to the point where people accept the idea of getting messenger RNA injected into their arms. And then you could launch all these other projects. They've got a huge number of projects going on right now, building messenger RNA vaccines against everything under the sun. I think they're going to produce all kinds of, vaccines against various disease agents and also vaccines to treat cancer. They're very excited about the mRNA technology. And they have very little evidence that it's safe, or effective.
That's a good point. Yeah, it's such a good point. It wasn't simply about get rich quick off a vaccine. It was actually giving you an entirely new medical modality, which isn't even really classifiable as a vaccine, is it? It's a new technology.
You shouldn't really call it a vaccine. Mm. It's just really gene therapy.
Mm. And it was funded by the NIH and Eco Health Alliance, which was funded by the U.S. government and the DOD. So yeah, we have the enemy within that's creating all these additional poisons for us. And we didn't mention prions, which are another interesting little disease vector.
Certainly talk about that.
That's just a folded protein. So we're talking something even smaller than exosomes and quote viruses, if they exist. So yeah, that whole process is interesting. I happened to be at the Restoring Hope Conference in Conroe, Texas this afternoon. And guest speakers include the attorney, Tom Rentz, that's working on medical freedom, Dr. Ryan Cole, Dr. Richard Uso, Dr. Stellar Emanuel, Kerry from Texas Vax Freedom, the pilot that suffered a heart attack, and founded U.S. Freedom Flyers, Bob Snow, Brooke Jackson, who's the one that blew the whistle on the fake clinical trials here in Texas with Pfizer, is one of the speakers. So I'm getting to talk to a whole bunch of really interesting people, and it's going to continue until 10 o'clock. So I might actually sneak off a few minutes early just to get back in there and hear some more speakers. But Nikki Willis is here. Del Bigtree's here. A guy that's a blogger named Derek Bros. Very interesting. And I've got us a whole month or two worth of scheduled speakers just from this one meeting. It's
That's wonderful.
That's the way we beat people. We network and we make sure that we find the people that can get the information out. We do everything we can to improve our circle of contacts.
That's awesome, Joe. Great stuff. Great work.
Yeah. I want to also add to the mix, give a shout out to Lady Carla Davis over at Masters of Health. She helped to bring on many, many experts into our TNT shows, and it's something that we really value. It's all about coordinating and building networks. And, you know, Stephanie, you've been good at that. You speak very well. You've done some great interviews, and I really enjoyed your interview listening to that earlier with Dr. Tom Cowan. Because I know Dr. Cowan, Sam Bailey, and Andy Kaufman are very much on this idea of pushing forward terrain theory. And, you know, we're all open-minded. And see, we're having an honest debate about it. We don't agree.
I agree about the terrain theory. I agree about that. That is the source of the problem, not the infectious agent. It's because your terrain is not healthy that you get sick.
Yeah, totally.
And if you're healthy, you won't even get sick from the virus. You might get exposed to it and you just wipe it out really quickly because you have a very effective immune system.
Yeah, I've been meeting a lot of people who, with the publication of my new book, that have come up to me and said, you know, we've never had a vaccine and we're extremely healthy. And that it's a growing proportion of the population who are now coming forward and saying, look, I've never had a vaccine in my life, never been ill, you know, no incidence of serious illnesses. And these people need to be, you know, given more of a platform because, you know, there's something to be said for that. And we talked about it on another episode about the Amish community in America.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that they are, you know, immune to these so-called diseases because they don't allow into their communities TV, radios, and, you know, the poison propaganda that encourages people to take these so-called treatments. Vaccines, you say they're not. They're definitely not vaccines. We're all guinea pigs. And I suppose that we could call the Amish community part of the control group, can't we?
Right. Yes. I think it's, I am very worried about the long-term effect of these vaccines. And, you know, I've read a lot of papers. It's hard to figure out the science, but there's a lot of science there. And one thing for sure is that as you get more and more booster shots from these with COVID vaccine, you get a weaker and weaker immune system. And that, I mean, it was really quite striking to me. First of all, the vaccine, you know, it's very different from the disease as far as how you react to it. And an important thing is that it does a very good job of inducing a huge levels of IgG antibodies to the spike protein. In other words, it does its job very, very well. And that's its intent, to produce antibodies to the spike protein, does it very, very well. But there's a problem with that because those IgG antibodies, when there aren't enough IgA antibodies to compensate for them, they can become very dangerous with attacking your own tissues through this process called molecular mimicry, because there's a lot of sequences in that spike protein that are similar to sequences in major human proteins that are associated with autoimmune disease. And so when you get too many IgG antibodies, they will start attacking your tissues, and they'll cause things like multiple sclerosis, rheumatoid arthritis, you know, various problems in the gut. I mean, just a lot of different things. Autism even is probably an autoimmune disease. So Alzheimer's, you know, all these things. And so where was I going with that? Now, what's interesting is that the booster shot, there was a group that studied the booster shot response. And they found, first of all, that IgG4 started increasing over time after the second shot. And then when you got the booster shot, it shot up even more. And then after the booster shot, it continued to go up. And what's interesting about that is IgG4 is an IgG antibody that works against protection. It actually gets in the way of the other antibodies and prevents them from binding and doesn't protect you from infection. So it's actually telling your immune system to stand down. And I think that's happening because the body is recognizing that these IgG antibodies are so dangerous. We have to stop them. And that mechanism is that these antibodies transition into this other form that doesn't work in the way it's intended. It works the opposite. And that means that those people who keep on getting booster shots are going to be more susceptible to COVID and more susceptible to other diseases because of this suppression of the immune system that's happening with these IgG4s.
Another insidious factor is I want to just make the point that they're dropping the narrative with COVID and going back to giving the treatment through regular influenza vaccines, aren't they? So one way or another, they're trying to get it into our bloodstream. It's not just through the COVID vaccine. It's pretty insidious all around.
Yeah, I think they're hoping to come up with an RNA vaccine that covers both COVID and flu, I think. A combo,
Yeah. Yeah, and that they're legislating to get in any way they can. I think that the idea of, we talked about the mosquitoes in Florida, didn't we, Joe Olson? That's something, again, another threat vector there. They'll get us one way or another. And again, I think you're pointing the way forward by protecting yourself by eating cleaner, eating better, avoiding exposure, avoiding yourself exposure to the more contaminated, the obvious things that are contaminated. It's something to bear in mind. We're going to come back onto this in the second hour because it's such a diverse subject. And another thing we really want to talk to you about is the importance of sunlight, as you came up with the idea that vitamin D is another thing to talk about. Dr. Stephanie Setzer.